Igu Iluna, please rise. Ohea o ko e ko ka aha, inahe kuliana I mua o kea aha ho o kolo kolo ki I ki hanohono o ka moku aina o Hawaii. I nāi mai, I malio mai, I lohi I e ka leo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye, all persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard. I noho I lalo. Please be seated.
All right, please call the case.
Case number SCAP-23-63, State of Hawaii versus Alvin Tran. Arguing for plaintiff appellant cross appellee State of Hawaii, Daniel Hugo, deputy prosecuting attorney. Arguing for defendant appellee cross appellant Alvin Tran, Thomas Otake. Argument on the merits.
All right, good morning, aloha everyone. Just as a reminder, our proceeding today is being broadcast live on our YouTube channel as well as on Olelo. I'd like to welcome our substitute justices, Judge Jeffrey Crabtree and Judge Clarissa Molinow. Counsel, are you both ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
All right. Just so we to confirm, we have 30 minutes for each side. Mr. Hugo, you'll begin the argument with 23 minutes. You've reserved 7 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Otake, you have 30 minutes. We're going to give you a warning with 10 minutes to go. And again, my understanding is, Mr. Hugo, you'll both be arguing your appeal and with regard to the cross appeal. As you will too during your 30 minutes, Mr. Otake. All right, please proceed.
May it please the court. The jury heard a little girl testify that the defendant had repeatedly sexually abused her beginning when she was around 8 years old. After considering all the evidence that was presented, including the vigorous defense that was raised, that jury believed her, and every single one voted to convict the defendant of continuous sexual assault of a minor under the age of 14 years. 6 weeks later, the defendant moved to dismiss, claiming for the first time that the indictment inadequately described the offense. The circuit court eventually granted that motion, deciding first that sexual penetration and sexual contact were generic terms, and second, that the indictment did not detail the predicate acts of sexual abuse. The court erred in doing so. First, sexual penetration and sexual contact are not generic terms within the context of the continuous sexual abuse statute or continuous sexual assault statute. And second, an indictment that is charging a continuing offense can properly aggregate the predicate acts, which is what was done here. So whether evaluated under the appropriate rule of liberal construction for a post-conviction objection, or even under the stringent standard that is applied to a timely challenge. This indictment stated the essential elements of the offense, provided fair notice of the accusation, and apprised the defendant of any applicable double jeopardy defense, which is all that an indictment requires. So this court has had occasion to review the sufficiency of criminal charges before. And the case law on this is reviewed and discussed in our briefs. But the test here that's developed in Jardine is fairly straightforward. It's a two-step inquiry that first looks at whether or not there's any generic terms that are present, and second, if there are any ambiguous terms that remain. And the cure for a generic term is to specify. The cure for an ambiguous term is to provide the statutory definition. And while the brief does discuss the case law, here's a example that can illustrate it. Consider the definition of credit card. Imagine for a moment if the statute defined a credit card only to include those cards that are issued by Visa or MasterCard. That would be an example of a generic statute or a generic definition, because the ordinary person of reasonable understanding who's looking at, say, a charge of fraudulent use of a credit card is unaware that a Discover card is not covered or an American Express card is not covered. And so this person may mistakenly have the impression that the law could punish them for conduct that the statute actually does not reach. On the other hand, consider the definition of credit card as it actually appears under Section 708-800. It includes things like a debit card or an electronic benefit transfer card. That would be an example of an ambiguous statute because although it includes credit card, so anyone who's committed fraudulent use of a credit card with a credit card is on notice. Somebody who used an electronic benefit transfer card may not be immediately on notice just by looking at that term credit card. So given that it is an ambiguous definition, the cure in that case would be to provide the statutory definition.
I believe Mr. Otake is saying the indictment. I think he's saying several things, but one of which is that the indictment should have specified the type of penetration or contact that was alleged. What's your response to that?
So the definition that's present for sexual penetration is more analogous to what was present in State Against Mita, where there was a broadly inclusive list of different types of animal nuisances in that ordinance. And this court decided that that was not a generic term because it would be more like that second example of a credit card where any example of sexual penetration that a person, ordinary person of reasonable understanding, looking at the language of the charge, it's covered. So it's not an over-inclusive definition. In other words, the ordinary definition is not one that is actually misleads someone into believing that they have committed criminal conduct that actually isn't covered by the statute. So that's...
If you look at Jardine, and I can't recall if it's substantial or serious bodily injury that was at issue. I think it was serious, I believe. But there were five different examples in the statute of what that could constitute. Very different types of things, you know, concussion, burn, serious laceration, a number of different things. And the court's holding was it wasn't enough to just say serious or substantial bodily injury. You should identify, or the indictment should have identified, which of the five was at play. So in this case, I think Mr. Otake is saying you should have, or the state or should have, in drafting the indictment, should have specified the particular types of contact or penetration that were alleged. There are quite a few in the statute. Seems there were fewer proven at trial. Why not provide that notice to the defendant?
So substantial bodily injury, which was the definition that was at issue in Jardine, is an example of a generic term, first of all, because the ordinary person of reasonable understanding looking at that term may be misled into believing that there are types of injury that are actually not covered under the statute. So in our brief, we give the example of massive bruising. Somebody looking at the phrase substantial bodily injury might believe that massive bruising is covered. Actually, it isn't, because the statute is far more specific and identifies only five specific classes of injury. Now, what's also important when looking at those five different classes of injury is that the foundation, that the evidence that might be introduced would also depend on what type of injury is there. So, for example, if the state was charging someone with causing a laceration, it might be enough to bring forward photographs. We may not necessarily need medical testimony. On the other hand, if we're charging someone with a broken bone, they can anticipate the sort of evidence that we would be bringing in, an X-ray technician, for instance. This is related to the cases of sexual assault. If this court considers the holding of the Colorado Supreme Court in People Against Rodriguez, and the reason why that particular holding should be persuasive to this court is that one of the cases that this court cited in trying to set out the boundaries of what constitutes generic terms in Jardine was People Against Tucker, which was an embezzlement case in Colorado. And that case was actually reevaluated by the Colorado Supreme Court in the context of sexual assault prosecution in People Against Rodriguez. And there, because the types of sexual penetration that were at issue did not materially affect the defense that would have been raised, that's one of the reasons why the court found that it was not necessary to specify it in the indictment. It had been specified in the felony information. There was an argument about whether or not there was a variance.
In this case, I think you alluded earlier that there, because of the timing of the challenge, which was after the conviction but before sentencing, that what we've called the Mata Wells liberal construction rule could apply. Can you argue or present the court with your position regarding whether that rule does or should apply post-verdict but pre-sentence and pre-appeal, and if it does apply, how it would cut in this particular case.
Yes, Chief Justice Recklinwald, it should apply in this case because the Model Wells rule applies up until the moment of a finding of guilt. So in other words, it's a timely challenge right up until that finding of guilt, which was actually the case in Mata. It was a post-verdict, pre-sentencing case. Mata brought his challenge to the burglary indictment 10 weeks after the verdict. How it applies here is that the rule of liberal construction essentially sets out two instances in which a untimely challenge nevertheless can be sustained. First, if there's a failure to even state an offense, and second, if there is some prejudice, some demonstrable prejudice to the defendant. And so that would cover a case, for instance, of unfair surprise, where the defendant was completely sandbagged at trial. That's not the case here. There's no showing of demonstrable prejudice. And in fact, the court at the hearing took the discovery that was provided to the defendant as an exhibit at the hearing. That discovery is substantially what the complaint witness testified to. There was nothing that came out at trial about any sort of inconsistency in her report. And so ultimately, the circuit court's speculation that there might have been some variance between the grand jury, what the grand jury heard, and what the complaining witness testified to just isn't sustained by the record. So there's no showing of prejudice. And there is an offense that's stated here. Repeated acts of sexual contact or sexual penetration with a child under all the attendant circumstances that are laid out in the indictment clearly states an offense. So under the appropriate rule of liberal construction, yes, this court should find that the court erred. But even if this court applied the more stringent rule, which is what I'm arguing about, whether or not any of the terms here were generic, this court should also sustain the indictment.
Let's step back a little bit. You know, as far as the generic, you know, Jardine could be read to suggest that, you know, let's cut out all this legalese stuff. It has nothing. Let's not just put in definition after definition, which is somewhat complex, at least in the criminal arena, to inform a defendant about what charge they have to defend against. But we had another case after that, Garcia. And Garcia talks about the who, what, when, where. And basically just fixing stuff by saying a to wit, you know, hand vagina, for example, or whatever the actual conduct that's presented to the grand jury is. So why is it that just can't be done in this particular case? Now, and why can't indictments read that way?
So the test or the reading that the state is offering here, Justice Edens, is one where each of those has a clear link to due process. The idea that the indictment should winnow down the specific acts, I think it's using an archaic notion of what.
Mr. Hugo, could you speak in the mic a little more?
Yes, of course.
Thank you.
It's going back to a more archaic notion of what an indictment was, which is, if you look at some of the older cases, Territory against Puana, for example, where the reckless driving charge was thrown out because of a failure to specify who was in the zone of danger, that sort of specificity in indictment was necessary at a time when there was no discovery that was provided. Discovery is the proper cure because then it can provide the defendant.
But shouldn't an indictment or a charging document be the be-all and end-all? You not have to rely on discovery to later figure out what you're being charged with. In other words, I don't get this whole idea about, even when you're talking about the liberal standard or not, well, the person went through trial, there's some discovery, they should have known. So if we step back at the initial stage, why is it then that discovery, if you have sort of, let's call it a defective charge, or a charge is not as clear, it's too legalese, why should the discovery matter?
So Justice Edens, I don't think that the discovery is a cure for a defective charge. It's a question of what is the purpose of the charging instrument under our modern pleading rules. And essentially what the charging instrument does is it sets the target. It says, if the state proves the following, you can be convicted of this offense. And so what is necessary for the state to prove is, or to lay out in the indictment is, what is necessary for us in order to obtain a conviction? In other words, what's the target? The particular facts or the particular way that the state will prove that, that's the...
And I understand, and thank you. But I think one point that the defense is making is that, well, how do we even know what the grand jury found probable cause to decide if you don't have that specificity? So in other words, the grand jury could be charging or finding probable cause to charge a defendant with a crime, sexual conduct or sexual penetration, for example. But since it's so broad, the jury then might be finding something else. How do you respond to that?
And so Justice Edens, this goes back to really the initial argument that was present in Arceo. The prosecution brought Arceo on a continuing offense theory. That was what they convinced the Maui judge was the reason why they could present different acts. They did not necessarily need to elect one particular act. It was because they were arguing a continuing offense theory. So when it comes to continuing offenses, what the grand jury needs to find is the particular relationship. So the three predicate acts are just the constituent facts that are used to prove that relationship. But as long as it's the same relationship that the grand jury is charging, so the same victim, the same defendant, the same period of time, that's the culpable conduct. And as long as there's a congruence there, that's what the, and you can think about it in terms of with the jury instructions that are issued off of the indictment in any way materially differ from the jury instructions that would ultimately be given at trial. And they would not in this case, even if there might have been some variance in the predicate acts, because the predicate acts are just there to show the overall crime.
Okay. Jardine was a pre-trial, pre-conviction challenge, correct?
Yes.
So Justice. Was Garcia.
Yes, Justice.
Correct?
Yes.
And was there a pre-trial motion to dismiss the indictment in this case?
There was not.
And was there a motion for bill of particulars?
There was not.
Thank you.
So that suggests, and you know, so even if we were to find that the charge was defective, you are suggesting that, you know, I mean, the key on motor wells and all that is we're not waiting till final judgment or on appeal to raise it. And I think what you're saying is that's the same thing. Raising it final appeal is almost exactly the same thing as raising it post-verdict. In other words, the court has not had the opportunity to decide the issue. And it's almost like the defense perhaps getting two bites of the apple. So if we were to say that the charge was defective, and I think you've outlined it in your answer to the Chief Justice's question, you would still suggest that the liberal standard applies in your situation.
That's correct. And it goes back to the policy reason why the Mata Court adopted the rule of liberal construction in the first place. One of the things that they were concerned about was that this would encourage tactical delay by defense counsel. And in fact, you can think of it also as a penalty for those defendants who do raise a timely challenge, have Rule 48 stopped, have to litigate a motion to dismiss. Whereas if the rule of liberal construction does not apply to these sort of cases, why not just go through the trial, potentially get an acquittal, and then get a second bite at the apple? The state also cited the case of State versus Marino, where that particular defendant engaged in all sorts of dilatory conduct between pleading or changing his plea and ultimately sentencing. Again, a contrary construction in this particular scenario would encourage precisely that dilatory conduct because he could expand the opportunity to challenge the statute.
Yeah, I remember that case. That's the Gypsy case, I think.
That's
from
correct.
A long time ago. Let's shift gears a little bit. As far as the 707, 733.6 prosecution, you know, let's say there were four underlying acts of sexual conduct or sexual penetration. and the jury gets backstage and they're thinking about things, and the 12 jurors say, you know, it's 12-0, but it's 6-6 on the third acts. You know, if you had four sex third felony, C felony charges, you'd really only get two C felony convictions out of that. But here, you're 12-0, 12-0, 6-6, 6-6, you don't just get two C felonies, you actually get one A felony. I'm just wondering, how is that fair?
So the continuous sexual assault statute also puts a lot of limits on what prosecutors can do. So one of the things, for instance, is that no other felony sex offense can be charged during in the same proceeding. And functionally, an acquittal on a continuous sexual assault charge in that period is essentially also an acquittal for any other felony sex offense that could be brought during that period. So let's take that second defendant who is charged with the specific definite acts. If we were later to recover child pornography, let's say, we could charge that case because it was not known to the prosecution at that time. And that acquittal on those definite counts would not count as an acquittal for the
But other. I mean, wouldn't that be the same? I mean, usually when sex offenses are charged, there's usually a pretty broad gap. And that's one way to charge somebody from on or about this date to this date. And that's usually how we all understand that there's double jeopardy protections and you're precluded from charging that. So I do get that. But again, here's another example. Let's say there's 14 predicate acts on your continuous sex assault charge. 14 of them, you know, hand to, you know, whatever combination you can figure out, but there's 14 of them. You could also have the same situation where you're back in the jury deliberation room, the jurors, you know, 12-0, 12-0 on two of them, but then they go 1-11 on each of the remaining 12. Can you tell me how that's constitutional when you basically have found two almost unanimous sex acts, committed, but then every single one of the jurors says none of the other things happen except one juror each. Is it just you're continuous going back to it? Well, that's the crime. It's a continuous sex assault crime. Is that the response?
That would be one response, Justice Edmonds. But I just want to make sure I understand your question. In this case, there is at least jury unanimity as to two acts, and then there's no jury unanimity as to a third act, because in that case there wouldn't be a conviction. They would at least need to, agree that that three acts had been committed.
But each juror, though, so I as a juror, I go 12-0, 12-0, and I find the third act, but I'm the only one finding that third act. And then we have the same thing with each successive juror. I go 12-0, 12-0, and I'm the only one finding fifth act. So that's sort of the difference. Do you sort of get what I'm saying?
Yes. So okay. I understand your question now. And so I think the first issue is that, yes, this is just something that comes up with continuing offenses because the predicate acts are not viewed as sort of elements that need to be proven. They're just facts that go to the overall offense. So that would be one thing. But this is also just a policy judgment that the legislature made ultimately in deciding to set this as a continuing offense. And one of the reasons why is that if you have one child molester who commits a single act of sexual contact, that person is not going to be able to argue any of these specific unanimity issues. But if you have somebody who repeatedly does this to a child, and because of the repeated nature of that abuse, there is traumatic memory recall, and there might be some issues with that, which is what came up in Arceo. Arceo was 6 years, the minor in that case was 6 years old when he went to the grand jury. And by the time trial came up at 9 years old, he wasn't able to recall some of those acts. And what we're talking about here are acts that inflict extreme trauma upon children. And so this is just a realistic concession to that fact and a refusal to provide an out for the most vicious class among these predators, the people who repeatedly do this so often that nobody on the jury doubts that this happened over and over and over again to the same child.
Anything further at this time? Or do you want to reserve your time for rebuttal after we hear from Mr. Otake?
Unless the court has any brief questions on the cross appeal.
We'll hear from Mr. Otake and then we'll have you back for your rebuttal.
Thank you. Good morning, may it please the court. In every opportunity that I get to come and argue before this honorable court in this historic building, it's always a really special one for me. And that's even more so true when we're here discussing a case with such substantial and compelling constitutional issues. I mean, we're here talking about due process, equal protection, separation of powers. And it's a significant case, and I appreciate this court granting our motion for transfer so that this court could hear it in the first instance. I'll start with the issue of the state's appeal. Our position obviously is that the circuit court's order was solid, straightforward, and well-reasoned. And I would submit the reason for that is because the guidance this court provided in State versus Jardine was equally solid, straightforward, and well-reasoned. It could not be more straightforward, the test that was provided in Jardine. You look at first, whether or not there's a generic term. I want to point something out. Respectfully, I think the prosecutor is combining the two terms into one. Step one, is there a generic term? If yes, then you have to descend to the particulars and the species. Step two, is there any terms that may be ambiguous that are different from the ordinary meaning? If so, use the statutory language. Those are two separate things. A term isn't become generic only if it means something other than the understanding of the public. I just don't see any way around the fact that sexual contact and sexual penetration are generic terms. Generic terms as defined by Jardine. This is a quote. A term is generic if it relates to or is characteristic of a whole group or class. Substantial bodily injury listed out a variety of things. Sexual penetration, at least seven different species in the statute. Sexual contact, somewhat of a vague definition, but easily at least six, seven, or eight different iterations of it. It's a generic term, and Jardine could not be clear. If there is a generic term, in order for it to state an offense, you have to descend to the particulars, you have to descend to the species.
Did Jardine overrule Mata Wells?
Well, in this regard, this is what I would say about that. I wouldn't say it directly overrules Mata Wells. What I would say is if there is Jardine error, it gets past the presumption of validity that Mata Wells establishes. All Mata Wells says is if you raise it, which by the way, our position is very clearly from cases like State versus Kalhane, State versus Wells, State versus Shaw, the language from those cases couldn't be more clear. Mata Wells applies if issue is being raised for the first time on appeal. Makes sense because Rule 12b-2 of the Hawaii Rules of Penal Procedure.
Because that was the facts in that case, right?
That was, well.
But the real issue is it's a post-conviction challenge, right? Well, when the judge doesn't have a chance to amend the charge.
I bring up the Rule 12b-2 because I think it's really important. It's a rule of penal procedure that specifically says you have to bring challenges to the indictment before trial, unless you're raising whether or not there's a failure to state a claim. And the rule says if you're doing that—
Are you arguing that this indictment failed to state a claim?
In part, it's under Jardine scrutiny, it doesn't state an appropriate
offense. Did we really say that in Jardine, that it didn't state an offense? Because that's a totally separate issue.
Well, in any event, what we're saying is this indictment doesn't pass Jardine scrutiny. And then what we're saying after that is if it doesn't pass Jardine scrutiny, it does. You get past the presumption of validity in Mata versus Mata Wells rule. A Jardine violation gets past that presumption, and it's just a presumption. Doesn't mean that it carries the day. I just also point out, just to be fair, I mean, well, two things. I point out I wasn't the attorney doing the trial.
I came on after, and Jardine was issued a week after the verdict. I mean, just to be fair, I mean, this was not a case when we talk about dilatory tactics or strategic decision. Jardine was issued, I believe, a week after the verdict in this case.
Many of the cases that it discussed or relied on had been issued long before, correct?
That's correct. I mean, and obviously it was pending before the court when the trial went. So that's fair. You know, one issue I really want to, I mean, so without a doubt in my mind, sexual contact, sexual penetration, generic terms, Jardine has to apply. Now, I want to, two important things, because I know there was may have been a question or a statement that, well, if it's a continuous offense, you don't need to get into Jardine. Well, I would ask the court to respectfully to go back and really read the Robago decision and how Robago talks about this issue. Not about on grounds of, unanimity, but on the issue of whether or not this was a continuing course of conduct crime. And my point is, the legislature can say whatever they want about it. Well, we're going to say it's a continuing course. It's the exact same statute that the court in Robago said, we're talking about three distinct acts. We're not talking about a continuous course. And in any event, there's nothing that stops this court from saying Jardine scrutiny should apply to an offense like this, whether or not the legislature said it's a continuing course of conduct or not. And so I think that's an important point. As to the discovery issue, 100%, I think this is a great opportunity for the court to clarify this issue. It's been an issue down in the circuit court after Jardine. Does discovery cure Jardine violations or not? And absolutely it should not, and for several reasons, as we state in our brief. The first is, like we stated, it really is, the prosecutor with this guidance chose not to follow it and appropriately charge the case, and then we're supposed to rely on the prosecutor to properly fulfill their discovery obligations to cure the issue. That's not something that I personally am willing to trust. Secondly, the two points of Jardine, first being to provide the notice required constitutionally. Maybe discovery helps with that, even though in a lot of cases, discovery might be so voluminous that how do you really know what exactly we're talking about? But more importantly, the congruence issue, the policing issue that an indictment plays to make sure that what a grand jury finds probable cause on is the same thing that the petit jury convicts. Discovery does nothing to solve that problem.
Went back and looked at Jess and Russell and the cases you cite, and they seem to me to stand for the proposition that if the indictment omitted an element in Jess, the element of that might lead to an enhanced sentence. In Russell, there was discussion of, the nature of the particular testimony that was being given before Congress would pass it. Whether the grand jury found that element or not, or even if it had any evidence, but that doesn't seem to be the situation here. I mean, the elements of the offense seem to be alleged, at least as I understand it, in the indictment. So I'm not sure how those cases stand for the proposition that you're talking about, Mr. Otake, which seems to be a need for 100% congruence between the evidence in the grand jury and the evidence at trial, as opposed to whether the elements were presented to the grand jury or not.
Well, I think the problem, which I see as a significant one, is if the grand jury found probable cause on some acts, certain set of acts, and the trial jury is convicting on completely separate acts. I see that as a big problem. And discovery doesn't cure that. The only way that can be cured when you're dealing with a generic term is to specifically get down to the species and the particulars in the indictment. And I don't think that's too much to ask in a case like this. Sexual penetration, 7 different definition, sexual contact, somewhat limited, 7 or 8 different ways it could happen. It's not too hard, it's not too much to ask that put in the indictment the scope of what the complaining witness is saying happened.
Can I ask you, are you saying, and I went back and looked at your motion to dismiss, and it seemed to be saying, and maybe I'm misunderstanding, both that the indictment should have identified which of those 7 types of contact or penetration occurred, but also to go farther and provide details about when, where, what? So that is it your position the indictment has to say this type of sexual contact on or about March 23rd, which seems
contrary to the intent of the statute.
Well,
the
I think all we're suggesting is the more detailed, the better, obviously. But at a minimum amount, we got to at least get into the species or particulars. And I think we point out really what this indictment says when you break it down is any type of one of these 15 different types of penetration or contact at any place over the course of any time over 5 years. And at the very least, Jardine has got to stand for when there's a generic term like sexual penetration and sexual contact, it's not asking too much to provide the notice of what species are we talking about.
So that's where your argument stops, because it seemed to go farther in the motion to dismiss. That's what I'm trying to
clarify. And the reason it went farther is because of the two-wit instruction and language that comes from Jardine, right? I think Jardine, this court seemed, in that opinion, to encourage prosecutors, why not go farther and include two-wit and get, you know, get more into the specifics, you know? So that's where that came from. I stand by that, but at the very least, you know, it doesn't meet Jardine scrutiny if you don't get into the species or particulars when there's a generic term. I think that, to me, is clear. And you know, for what it's worth, I think it does overcome the presumption if the court decides to approve the Amato Wells test.
But isn't the presumption whether it would even could even be interpreted to charge a crime, I believe. I'm looking for my...
They're reasonably construed to state an offense, charge
state
a crime.
State an offense.
Right.
So this charge, which tracks the statute and has the definitions of penetration and contact, how does that not charge an offense or state an offense?
Because in Jardine, it says that it stands for the indictment is defective. And because doesn't appropriately charge the offense. And we don't see any reason why that shouldn't meet the standard here.
Mr. Otake, had a motions for bill of particulars pursuant to 806-47 been filed, is it your position that that would have cured some of these concerns that are raised in your pleadings?
You know, that's a good question. I mean, I would, first of all, imagine the state would have objected to that for the same reason they're doing now. You know, I don't think that necessarily would, because the problem is, on the policing grounds, what did the grand jury indict on? A bill of particulars is after the grand jury found probable cause. And we don't know if what the state is now saying, okay, we're gonna say these are the particulars. They didn't say that before the grand jury. And so we don't know if that's what the grand jury found PC on. And we can't be sure that there's gonna be congruence between that and what a trial jury finds. And so, you know, I don't believe that cures the problem. It's something that needs to be in front of the grand jury so we know exactly what the grand jury found probable cause on. You know, I want to make sure I leave time for our appeal. But
yeah, you know, and let me ask you the constitutional aspect and the Ramos. You know, so Ramos basically saying, you know, Louisiana, Oregon, you know, you can't have 10-2 verdicts and non-unanimous verdicts violate the Sixth Amendment. But Ramos, as I read it, does not require unanimity on how the defendant committed the crime. In fact, Ramos talks about Richardson, which is a robbery case where your knife gun didn't really matter. So why should we read Ramos to require unanimity for specific underlying acts when there may be several ways for the defendant's conduct to constitute an element of a crime?
So there's two things. You know, I'm not saying we are arguing what you just stated, but I think there's another argument that we're making. Ramos versus Louisiana, you know, in a nutshell, stands that states are not free to mess with the unanimity requirement. And what we're saying is put aside 707.733.5 or 0.6 for a second. And let's look at Article 1, Section 25, the plain language of it. What is the constitutional amendment that was adopted? And it's broad. What it says is what the legislature may define in cases of continuous sex assault crimes against minors, what constitutes the jury unanimity that is required for a conviction. That's, in our opinion, that plain language goes beyond what the circuit court found. What that means is our legislature could mess with unanimity. Our legislature our legislature could.
Well, if they did and they said, hey, look, three jurors can find unanimity, that would be unconstitutional. I mean, that's what I think would be wrong. But I think what the prosecution is saying is something different. Is they're talking about unanimity on the how a case can be proven, how an element can be proven. It can be conducted, it could be proven in various ways. And I think distinction.
And that's why we're challenging in the first instance, Article 1, Section 25, not necessarily directly the statute. What we're saying is that Article 1, Section 25 was written poorly, where the plain language of it violates Ramos versus Louisiana.
But the plain language of it is different than the Louisiana and Oregon Constitution, which specifically in those statutes say that a 10-2 verdict is okay.
It's a different statute that obviously we're dealing with here, but the language that the legislature adopted was more expansive than I think what Ramos and Louisiana allows. And you know, to be clear, that's just our first challenge to this issue. We raise an equal protection challenge and a separation of powers challenge to this issue. This idea that we here in our state, we allow the legislature to carve groups of people out of certain rights that everyone else gets. That's just not equal protection. And the other thing that I have a big issue with is this idea that, you know, this court with its supervisory powers is can rule and say the statute is unconstitutional, you know, and then legislature just amends it to make it constitutional. I mean, I see that as a problem. And it's as evidenced, I mean, you know, honestly, I mean, here we are in 2023 and Article 1, Section 23 of our state constitution still says the legislature could define marriage only being between opposite sex couples in 2023.
You know, if there's a tension between another constitutional provision, let's say Article 1, Section 5, our due process clause, and another provision, and I guess it could apply to the same-sex marriage as well. What do we do when there's, I guess, tension between two constitutional provisions?
Well, that's the problem with allowing these carve-outs to come later. I mean, obviously the due process is as embedded in our Constitution as any clause could be. And the problem is, as time went on, when we allowed by popular vote to carve out, you know, these, you know, people from certain rights, that's where that problem stems from. So I would say in a situation like that, weight has to be given to the due process clause. You know, this idea, page 11 of the state's answering brief, the state wrote, "This court cannot settle all social questions. And so when presented with contrary democratic mandates, it should accept the people's verdict." You know, I take issue with that. You know, I don't believe that constitutional issues should be, you know, decided by public vote. If that's the case, we wouldn't need a Supreme Court. We wouldn't need a constitution. I mean, I think we all, you know, familiar with the phrase, you know, what's popular isn't always right, and what's right isn't always popular. And likewise, what's popular isn't always constitutional, and what's constitutional isn't always popular.
So I guess what you're saying is, an amendment's passed by the legislature, it's ratified by the people. If it's unconstitutional, it doesn't fly.
It's unconstitutional. This court has, under separation of powers, this court has to be able to review that. It has to. I mean, it's.
Can I ask you another question, and it's somewhat a little different that I've been kind of thinking about? You know, is your argument that the three or more acts requirement under 707.733.6 is one element or three elements?
Well, I would answer it this way. I do not believe, regardless of what the legislature calls it, that it is a continuous offense in the sense that we've all come to understand it through the case law provided by this court through the years. I think they are three separate and distinct acts that, as you know, Rabago has a lot of good language about that come from three separate and distinct impulses that could happen, you know, anytime over 5 years. And so to your question, you know, I would say it is, in that sense, it is elements. It is separate things that need to be proven to the jury. And your point is a good one. I mean, I never really thought about it mathematically that way, but everyone could agree on two, and there could be 12 different acts that each different person agrees to, and that means they all agreed on three. It's just 14 separate ones, and you know, it's a problem. And so again, I really was, Rabago made a lot of sense to me when they were talking about whether this is a continuous offense or not. You know, it doesn't fit what we've come to understand as continuous offenses. It just doesn't. And
but is the legislature, or more to the point, the people who adopt the constitutional provision bound by our interpretations of different statutes that might talk about continuous offenses or different contexts in which we talk about something being a continuous offense for a statute of limitations or some other purpose? How it might inform the discussion, but it sounds like you're saying the people are bound by what we've said in some other context. I'm not sure I follow.
Well, in a constitutional aspect, and you know, Rabago dealt with this directly. Obviously, it was before Article 1, Section 25, but you know, the Rabago court said, it is the province of this court and not the legislature, ultimately, to ascertain whether for purposes of HRS 707.733.5, multiple acts of sexual penetration or sexual contact may be deemed a continuous offense. We hold that such acts are by nature separate and discrete and therefore may not form the basis of a continuous offense. So, I mean, I understand what the effort was back then, but I don't think that robs this court of its supervisory powers, you know, in providing constitutional scrutiny to these things, even Article 1, Section 25. I mean, if you really think about the ramifications of that, I mean, we could by public vote change anything.
So you're saying that when Bayer versus Lewin came back up, this court should have ordered that same-sex marriages take place despite Article 1, Section 23, instead of following the will of the people and the intent of the people.
I'm just suggesting that under separation of powers, the Supreme Court has got to play a role in vetting some of these things that are passed.
The power is to the people. That's where the power actually lies,
well,
right?
That's the fundamental
power, not the courts, not the branches of government.
I don't disagree with that. And I'm glad you brought that up, because there's some reference in the state's brief that somehow I'm against democracy, because I'm suggesting the Supreme Court, you know, have some policing powers over what's constitutional and what's not. And I'm just as for democracy as the next guy. It's just scary to me to think that by popular vote, we can just undo constitutional rights.
That happens in many states where it's much easier to amend the Constitution than in our state.
But isn't that then when the possible tension between other constitutional provisions come into play?
And that's exactly, and this is all I'm saying, and I think it was Evitz, or I forget the name of the case, but if you want to amend the Constitution, you want to add rights, you want to take rights away, just do it for everyone. You know, don't carve out, okay, we're gonna take away rights from this group. We're gonna add rights for that group. I mean, you know, I don't know how that flies.
And so you're saying, had the legislature just said, the legislature may define continuing offense for all offenses of any kind, that would be better? That would be more protective of individual rights?
Well, it would remove the equal protection argument if they did that, but there may be other arguments at that point. But, you know, so, you know, I mean, for what it's worth, you know, I completely agree, you know, the power is in the people's hands and things like that, but all I'm saying is, you know, our whole system, I think, throughout time has been, you know, one that, you know, it's not just about what's popular. It's about what's constitutional. I mean, I got here early today. I walked downstairs into the, you know, martial law exhibit and you know, read about Japanese internment. I mean, I'm sure at the time that was probably would have won a popular vote. That doesn't mean it was right or constitutional.
Isn't the argument from the state that this is a matter, there's no suspect class claim being raised here, which would be a very different argument or discussion. But in this case, it's a rational basis review. He's not claimed to be a member of a suspect class. He's claimed to be someone who engages in a certain type of conduct that the legislature rationally believed needed to be addressed in a certain way.
And equal protection, rational basis analysis, what we point out is it's not a rational basis when you're starting from a presumption of guilt. When the idea is this person is accused, we need to make it easier to prosecute him because he's guilty. It's not rational, not under the presumption of innocence. You can't start with a presumption of guilt and say, well, we need to change this so we can prosecute him, get a conviction. It's easier.
I think Mr. Hugo would say that the legislature was pointing out that young children simply can't remember dates and specifics. So it's not an animus towards these folks, although there certainly are comments in the history that suggests that folks obviously find these types of crimes shocking. But the goal, as articulated by the legislature, seemed to be to address a particular problem that rose in these cases. And by the way, the Supreme Court acknowledged that in Richardson.
Well, and you know, I think I would hope, you know, obviously there's no issue as to the heinous nature of these crimes and nobody's suggesting otherwise, but, you know, from a, you know, constitutional perspective, we're not talking about the nature of the crime. We're talking about, and I'm not saying there was animus. I'm saying the result is the approach cannot meet a rational basis when it's based off of the presumption that someone's guilty. So we need to make it easier to prosecute them. You know, that's just our position on that. So, you know, I don't know if there's any other questions. I understand these are significant issues, a lot of room on different issues to provide more guidance. I think the discovery issue in Jardine is a good opportunity. I think it is a good opportunity to visit these carve outs of amending the Constitution to carve certain people out of rights. And, you know, under Jardine especially, I just don't see how it's not a generic term. It's hard for me to envision that. But in any event, you know, that's basically what we have to say. Like I said, it's always a privilege to honor here, an honor to argue here. And so unless there's any other questions, I thank the court for their time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Otake. Mr. Hill, your rebuttal.
I want to start with a response to Justice Eden's question about how we construe constitutional provisions when there appears to be a tension between them. And the operative test is to construe the instrument to harmonize it as a whole, but also to look at the specific intent of each constitutional provision. So the specific intent and the background history, which the state reviews in its brief, that's what's important here in construing whether a term like due process should be allowed to extinguish what was the specific intent of the people in passing on this particular provision. I also disagree with how opposing counsel has characterized equal protection, because equal protection is not about uniform treatment. I mean, the entire criminal law is about making these very fine distinctions. One of the distinctions distinguishes sexual offenses from other offenses might be the availability of defenses. There certainly are some defendants who might wish that they could raise a consent defense when they're being prosecuted, but the legislature and this court has not allowed them to raise those particular defenses. In an assault prosecution on an elderly person, it is sometimes a defense that the person did not know or reasonably know that the person was over the age of 60. But this court has construed a strict liability provision when we're talking about these particular classes of offenses. So the fact that sexual offenses are treated differently has to go back to whether or not it passes rational basis review. And it does, because the intent of this particular statute was to look at a particular class of sexual predators who repeatedly preyed upon children, either because they had recurring access to those children or because they were resident in the home. And so that's one of the reasons why there's a rational link between that and not requiring a specific unanimity, because the abuse happens so often that it would be unreasonable in the legislature's judgment to require a child to be keeping like a calendar of each time that the sexual abuse occurred.
Can I ask you that? A similar question asked Mr. Otake is, you know, when I look at Ramos, you're talking about, you know, underlying acts and specific unanimity for underlying acts, and there's somewhat being a difference in there being several ways or manners in which to prove an element of the crime. And in 7733.6, that's really the element of the crime, the three or more acts. So can you tell me what your take on Ramos is as to the unanimity and whether it's really underlying acts or the element idea?
So first of all, the Justice Edens, the clear holding in Ramos was addressing two states that allowed non-unanimous jury verdicts. And in fact, in Justice Gorsuch's opinion, he cites the fact that 48 states in the federal system do not require would not allow a non-unanimous verdict in the way that Louisiana did. He could not have made that claim if he was talking about specific unanimity, because the federal court sometimes denies specific unanimity instruction requests, and because many states, California, Texas, Iowa, allow for, in this particular context, for the jury to not be unanimous on the predicate acts of sexual abuse.
Sorry to interrupt.
And so, yes, Justice Edens, in response to your question as to whether we see it as three elements that the state must prove or a single element, we see it as a single element. Once it's been established that three or more acts occurred, then that establishes the existence of a particular type of abusive sexual
relationship. Because 702.205 doesn't say elements is acts, it says conduct.
Correct, Your Honor.
Right?
Yes, correct, Justice McKenna. And that's exactly how a continuing course of conduct offense is construed. It looks at it aggregates the individual predicate acts into one continuing course of conduct. I just wanted to briefly go back to the Jardine argument and address Judge Molinow's question about a bill of particulars. I think a bill of particulars might be appropriate in the sort of case that Justice Nakayama raised as a hypothetical in her dissent in Arceo, which is a case where maybe there's a dispute that the defendant says, okay, two of these acts occurred, but not the third one. That might be a case where the defendant's specific defense is going to rely upon identification, then a bill of particulars might be appropriate there. But that doesn't go to whether or not the charge was appropriately stated. So I see the bill of particulars as something where the defense is evaluating the evidence and says we need more information in order to run the specific type of defense that we intend to run here. Not a question of whether or not the charge was adequately stated, and certainly not as a supplement to the state's duty to provide fair notice of the accusation, which we believe this indictment did, and then to provide the notice that is required under discovery. And, you know, if we're going to talk about voluminous discovery, just imagine if the indictment becomes the vehicle for discovery. This court might recall many years ago, there was that awful case in Austria, the Joseph Fritzl case, where the abuse had occurred over decades. Joseph Fritzl had locked his daughter in a basement, and that abuse occurred over decades. Now, if it was required in the indictment to specify every single episode of abuse, first of all, you'd have an extremely voluminous charging document. Second, there's nothing there that isn't cured by providing discovery to that particular defendant. But third, it creates the possibility of perhaps an argument about whether or not there's a variance between the pleading and the proof, and an entirely unnecessary argument. And it would afford this defense only in the cases where defendants had Chief Justice,
I finish your thought.
In those cases where the abuse had gone on so often and on such a remorseless and ruthless level that it does become voluminous, it wouldn't apply to the person who did a single gunshot to the head, but it would apply to the person who mutilated a corpse, let's say. And that just isn't ultimately a fair and just outcome.
Anything further at this time?
No.
All right, thank you to both of our attorneys today for your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Eku Iluna, please rise.
Ua ho o malolo ia mai ne, kea aha ho o kolo kolo ki e ki hano hano o komoku aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court is now recessed.